This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Shartz Abdullah and you are listening to The Breakfast Grill. The name in Marsette entered the consciousness of the Malaysian public and the rest of the world in the wake of MH370 tragedy. In Marsette, a British company was set up in 1979 and was originally known as the International Marine Satellite Communications Organization. They are now a publicly listed FTSE 250 satellite telecommunication player, providing connectivity services beyond maritime, including government, aviation, and enterprises. Now, that telecommunication service providers are defining the next chapter of connectivity through 5G technology, what will the role be for satellite service providers like Inmarsat in the next 5 years? So joining me on The Breakfast Grill this morning to discuss Inmarsat's role in telecommunications in the next few years is Todd McDonald, the President of Global Government of Inmarsat. Good morning, Todd. Thank you for joining us on The Breakfast Grill.
Good morning, Shards. Thank you.
Now, Todd, Inmarsat played a key role in narrowing the search and rescue area for the missing MH370. Did the tragedy spur any developments in the global flight tracking technology?
Yes, it did, actually. One of the tricks with that technology is that all of this data is invested on the aircraft. So we talk about black boxes, or if anybody's ever seen a picture of one, they're actually orange. And so all of the data to know what an aircraft has done is located on the airframe. And we came out and said, well, as Inmarsat, we're prepared to provide a concept such as black box in the cloud, so you could pull that information off the aircraft rather than keeping it on the aircraft and having to find the aircraft to recover it. You could actually have it already off the aircraft and just take that off at regular intervals. So, and there's still quite a lot of conversation in the aviation industry about that idea. I think you and I were talking about this earlier, but we've developed a new service called Swift Broadband Safety, and that is about providing a continuously updated data link between the ground and air traffic control and the cockpit of the aircraft. And that also ties to what we call the EFB, the electronic flight bag, so pilots can get up to date weather updates and new routing information and so on, because in fact there's a lot of information you need if you want to adjust your flight, a commercial airline's flight. And it's come out recently, the FAA, the American Federal Aviation Authority, has said they wish to use our technology, or the ADS-C technology, which is what Swift Broadband Safety is based on, to track aircraft in their airspace, because that allows them to do things like manage aircraft traffic more closely, which means they can reduce the amount of separation safely between aircraft and so on. It's a great efficiency benefit. And, of course, that includes things like position, altitude, and so on.
So, I mean, in relation to this, the Specialized Agency of the United Nations for Aviation, they'll be launching the Global Aeronautical Distress and Safety System, GADS, as it is known, a flight tracking mandate for all new aircraft to help prevent the loss of aircraft in distress. Now, Inmarsat has its SBS, or Swift Broadband Safety, which enhances safety. Does it serve the purpose of GADS, and how has the take-up rate been, Todd?
So I should emphasize here, my area of specialty is government, and I can talk probably a bit more about military aviation than commercial aviation, but we're certainly involved with ICAO and the various other international aviation organizations. Swift Broadband Safety does, under the ADS-C technology, provide information, or the sorts of information that GADS is designed to operate with, and that's certainly one of the things that the FAA in the US picked up on as well. So we do see Swift Broadband Safety as a big extension of the cockpit-to-ground communications, which includes all of the things such as position services, SAR, search and rescue services, or the ability of search and rescue services to find aircraft and so on. So those technologies are tied into ADS-C.
And Todd, do you think that this technology will eventually be mandatory for airlines as part of their overall tracking system?
So it's hard to say mandatory, because of course that's got to be driven by the various regulators around the world, and ICAO is of course a key part of that. But often I find with these things, or my observation of these things, is that airlines wind up fitting it anyway because it's part of their marketing story. As it's a bit like in-flight connectivity. As more and more airlines fit the technology, an airline that doesn't have it is not as capable as its competition. So I think what will happen is the market will drive itself to fit the technology because people won't want to fly on an aircraft that doesn't have that technology once it becomes mainstream.
So all this came about as a result of the MH370 tragedy. In the perspective of Inmarsat, during the first few hours of the MH370 was thought to have disappeared, Inmarsat was in contact four times through its hourly automated handshake. Besides the automated handshake, is there an automated trigger mechanism in place within the Inmarsat system that could have alerted the authorities that MH370 have gone off course?
So the technology we're talking about in the case of MH370 wasn't designed to provide any positional information at all, actually. In telco terms, we classically use the term Aloha, and it's the way a terminal or a device, like your mobile phone, for example, says to the network, if I want a channel, can I have one? And in fact, the communication, the hourly communication between the MH370 aircraft and our satellite was simply that. You know, if it's the norm, the reason it happens hourly is because our network needs to know, well, could that aircraft want to use our services over the next little while? Because we need to plan within the network, you know, do we need to be able to provide a resource to that aircraft? So that's why the amount of data involved here is tiny and includes no positional information. And so our team, some very, very clever engineers sat down and used a lot of complex mathematics to break down that data and the amount of time it took for that data to go back and forth between the aircraft and the satellite to gain some understanding of what the positioning might be, and that's how that was put together. There was nothing in that signaling at all that was designed to give a position. It was purely just to say, was there a channel available or not? Would the aircraft want one?
Does that mean that should the air traffic controllers were to alert Inmarsat that they did not register MH370 in its airspace, would Inmarsat be able to have given the air traffic controllers the positioning of MH370?
Unlikely. So the type of technology that MH370 was carrying was primarily designed to allow voice traffic with the aircraft. So the way to find out where the aircraft was would be to call it. And that wouldn't be an Inmarsat task, of course. The airline could do that themselves. So compared to today's technology with things like Swift Broadband Safety and so on, where we do know where the terminal is, that is part of the signalling between the satellite terminal and the aircraft and the network, the technology on MH370 was not like that. It was just purely I don't want to call it a sat phone because it's a bit more involved than that, but it basically designed to provide a voice connection to the aircraft.
Speaking to me this morning is Todd McDonald, the President of Global Government for Inmarsat. So Todd, internet connectivity has become essential and consumers' preferences has changed as a result of technology. Now with advancing technology, we can now have high-speed connectivity almost anywhere, remote areas, the skies, and even the seas. So the number of connected aircrafts are expected to double in the next 5 years, and you have established several partnerships to support this growth, particularly with Panasonic and Boeing, who are both leaders in their respective areas within the aviation industry. Do you foresee a time where revenue contribution from the aviation business might surpass those from the government and even maritime segment?
Well, I think we see growth opportunities across our business, really. Certainly, commercial aviation is a newer market. The passenger expectation of getting an internet connection on their flight now is very high. So that's why you're seeing so many airlines take that up. Of course, there are different ways to do that. So we are, I'm not sure how well it's known, but we actually built in a partnership with Deutsche Telekom a 4G network across Europe called the EAN, the European Aviation Network. And that technology, and we put a satellite over the top of that as well. So in fact, we're just rolling out this technology now. IAG, the British Airways group of airlines, as our launch partner, but there's some other customers for that. And so what the aircraft has a small antenna on its belly and a small antenna on it, on its roof, if you like, on the upper side of the aircraft hull. And as the aircraft flies across Europe, it can get our 4G towers to get a high-speed internet connection. And when it goes over water and something like that, it automatically switches to the special satellite we put over that part of the world and gets its internet from there and then flips back to the ground. So we did build that technology specifically for aviation, for commercial aviation. And so areas like that will grow or help grow the aviation business specifically. But to your point, everybody's expecting an internet connection. So we even see that in the government, you know, where when governments deploy people around the world, they know they not only need to provide connectivity for the operational requirements, but also for the welfare requirements. So people, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Coast Guard operators and so on, scientists, all expect to get the internet as well. So the saying, isn't there, a rising tide rises all ships. So we see as much opportunity in government, for example, as we do in commercial aviation.
Todd, you mentioned earlier that all these segments, you're looking at growth in, you know, not just aviation, you're also seeing growth in government as well as maritime segment. But looking at your most recent numbers, Inmarsat is experiencing a decline in its first and second half revenue for the maritime business. Would you be able to tell us why this is the case?
Look, there's a transition going on in the maritime business right now. So, and this goes to the heart of what we've been talking about, right? How important is connectivity? There's a program we're running with Rolls-Royce, for example, that's designed to automate shipping. So you could run an automated ship, basically. But that transition, our older technology is based on what we call L-band frequencies. It's a smaller type of channel you might. You know, it's a bit like talking about 2G, 3G, 4G. So those smaller channels, they were much more costly to operate, and the technology on the ships is different sorts of specialized technology. What's happening now is we're moving to a bigger pipe. You get more connectivity for similar or less cost. And so we're still servicing the same number of customers, in some cases possibly more customers. But as we move them from that older, high-cost technology to the newer, faster broadband, lower-cost technology, that's changing those numbers, if you like, the revenue we see for maritime. But what's also happening is that as we put these bigger connections on their ships, the shipping companies are saying, well, wait a minute, now we can do all of our software updates, we can do our ECDIS chart updates at sea, we don't have to do them alongside. We can provide welfare services for high-quality crew. We can get some surveillance on the ship with video systems, we can provide new weather and so on. So what we're seeing is the bandwidth utilization is going up, and so we believe that what will happen, they'll want to use more connectivity services. So as we get the new technology in the ships, they'll want to use much more, and as a result, they'll probably spend more on communications. In fact, they'll spend more on communications because that'll allow them to, say, spend less on fuel and so on by giving a more efficient route to the ship. So we just see that as a bit of a transition for maritime.
Joining us on The Breakfast Grill this morning is Todd McDonald, the President of Global Government of Inmarsat. We'll be right back with more discussions on Inmarsat's role in the development of 5G. So keep it here on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
You've tuned in to BFM 89.9. On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Todd McDonald, the President of Global Government of Inmarsat. Todd, on another subject with regards to broadband connectivity, spectrum is a valuable resource for telecommunication company and as well as satellite company like yourself. The World Radio Communication Conference is scheduled to be held in Egypt this coming October. Now, this is an important conference where representatives from all countries and global telecommunication players will be convening to make decisions which are binding by the international law. Now, spectrum allocation for 5G usage will be a contentious issue at this conference. How do you see satellite players like yourself faring when the bandwidth are going to be allocated?
That's a good question. I guess I'd say a couple of things there. First of all, we are, I think you mentioned earlier, well known for providing things like safety of life at sea, and we talked already about Swift Broadband Safety and so on. So a number of the frequency areas we already operate in are relied upon by people internationally for safety. So that, you know, the chances of people being very supportive or wanting to take spectrum away from those sorts of services, I thought, would be limited. Doesn't mean the mobile phone people and so on wouldn't reasonably argue they need the spectrum, but a lot of our services, because of that safety component, are seen as being very important. We also operate in the Ka band section, but that hasn't shown to be a very popular area for the 5G proponents. That's not really the area they're looking at. That's a very high frequency set. So for us, we are tending to operate in parts of the spectrum that are either important for other reasons or are not really attractive to things like 5G. But it's true. There is I've made the comment to people already that I perceive radio frequency spectrum awarded to have almost similar asset values these days because of the people's need to be connected. So there will be a debate about that. But these things always involve trade-offs. And so as they talk about, well, we want to repurpose one piece of spectrum to another job, that will have to take into account how that may impact the current users of the spectrum. And I think WRC 19 will have some lively debates about that.
And still on that subject, how do you see satellite companies sort of defend the allocation, especially on the lower 3 gigahertz segment when mobile telecommunication technology is expected to be playing a big role in the rolling out of 5G? And again, they are arguing that their services could be more reliable in that spectrum space.
So it's true. I mentioned already, these things always include trade-offs. So 3 gigahertz is what we call on the radio frequency bands, C-band, and that's important. That's particularly resilient to things like rain fade and so on, and so it's particularly important to Southeast Asia. While it's reasonable to argue that you could use those frequencies for great 5G access, that would mean that then you wouldn't have available a highly resilient way to deliver service to, well, certainly millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people in Southeast Asia. So I think that it would almost suggest that perhaps the telcos then would have to say, well, that's okay. If we have that spectrum, then we'll have to roll out services to the less populated areas, which will be a very costly exercise for them. So there's a trade-off there somewhere.
Right.
I think, you can't go saying, oh, well, the satellite operators just have to repurpose. And I should add that in the satellite business, you build a spacecraft and launch it and usually aim to operate it for 15 years. So if you've got a satellite operator running a satellite on 3 gigahertz and it's got, you know, more than half a satellite life left, and you suddenly say, well, the frequencies that satellite provides can't be used, there's a economic discussion to be had about how to offset that cost to the operator. There'll be money that'll have to move somewhere if that's what we're going to do that, and that will definitely take time. You can't just switch these things off, let alone develop even the 5G technologies to use them. So I'm not surprised there'll be the conversation, but I think if anybody thinks it's going to be a quick change, I'd be surprised. It's going to take a while.
Okay, more on the subject of 5G. Todd, 5G is estimated to be worth about $227 billion by 2025. What role do you see Inmarsat playing when it comes to the development of 5G technology as well as infrastructure?
So we always pay attention to these sorts of technological changes, particularly in the mobile networks area. So when we launched our I-4 satellites, that was based on 3G technology. In fact, we effectively use the 3G architecture to provide one set of services from our spacecraft. Then we built this EAN system in Europe based on 4G technology. So we see 5G as potentially an enabler for what we do. It could be used, you know, you could put a 5G cell on a ship that was fed by one of our satellite connections, or an aircraft for that matter. So we see 5G as another way to augment our services. We sort of see that as a nice way to deliver a common service with us behind the delivery of that service. And of course, the 5G standards are still very much in development. You know, there isn't widespread use or even widespread equipment available to use 5G. So we think we're certainly party to what's going on in that area so that we can pick up on that development when we think it's mature enough to add into what we're already doing.
And how fast are we talking about? I mean, the speed of broadband or the speed of connectivity that Inmarsat is currently offering.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to take maybe, it could be 3 to 5 years before you see widespread use of 5G. The next Olympics, I think it's the Tokyo Olympics, they're aiming to do quite a lot with 5G there. And there's a lot of people seeing that as a big, large-scale test case of what might be possible. But even then, you won't see widespread uptake until all the network operators manage to start implementing it. And often that's based on finalising standards and so on. So I would have said there was several years, two or three potentially, before you saw widespread uptake. And that's not taking into account the equipment manufacturers and so on as well. There's a real chicken and egg in these things. As people wait for the standards to be better defined, so the network hardware equipment makers can embed the technology with those standards in the network, then the handset manufacturers know what to make in the handset, and that's all got to roll around a bit more yet.
Okay, Todd, one last question before we end the interview. Now, I'm curious to find out about the most recent news that has been on the headline. Now, this is on the subject of the UK government blocking the massive $3.4 billion proposal by the two private equity firms to take Inmarsat company private pending a review. What were the factors that led Inmarsat to agree with this takeover to begin with?
Okay, so just a couple of things about the takeover. So there's actually four equity partners.
Yeah.
So there's Apax out of the United Kingdom, there's Warburg Pincus out of the United States, and there's two Canadian pension funds. They've come together to form a consortium to buy Inmarsat. Inmarsat is a publicly traded company listed on the London Stock Exchange. So basically, when you're a public company, in effect, you're always for sale. So if someone comes along with enough money and is able to buy all the shares in the existing shareholders, they basically have a right to do that. Mm. So that's what's happened here. So the four consortium partners have come together and offered a share price that caused the majority of our existing shareholders to say, yes, we're willing to sell our shares for that. Now, because of the sorts of services we provide, and we're a telecommunications provider and so on, regulators around the world have a say in those sorts of things. And so we're going through that process now. That includes the European regulators and United Kingdom regulators, United Kingdom government. So they're looking at the transaction. That's normal. We are a decent-sized organisation, and we are headquartered in London, so it would be normal for the English government to pay a lot of attention to that. Until the regulator comes out and says how they feel about it, I don't know. But nothing seems to be happening that's unusual for these sorts of transactions. So, for us, we're still sticking to our plans, still sticking to our investments. Since that announcement has been made, we've still ordered three more high-power Global Express Ka-band spacecraft. We've also announced our Polar project. So as a business, we are still doing exactly what we plan to do and still servicing the customers we plan to service, despite the fact that we may have a slightly different set or a different set of owners maybe next year.
Todd, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Breakfast Grill today. It's been a pleasure on my end. I've been speaking to Todd McDonald, the President of Global Government for Inmarsat. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shahid Sabdullah for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.